Welcome to the Faith and Works podcast, sponsored by the Interfaith Leadership Council of Metropolitan Detroit. The Faith and Works podcast takes a serious look at our religious and community values. What does our faith look like? How is it being expressed and lived out? Today's episode will feature Bob Brutel, Vice Chairman of the Interfaith Leadership Council and an Adjunct Professor of Religious Studies and History at the University of Detroit Mercy. He is joined by Interfaith Leadership Council Chair Reverend Stancy Adams. Reverend Adams is Associate Minister at Russell Street Missionary Baptist Church in Detroit and a hospital chaplain. In addition, we have Reverend Jimmy Wafer, Senior Pastor at New Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church. Pastor Wafer also serves on the board of the Interfaith Leadership Council. And last but not least, joining the podcast today, Frieda Sampson, Executive Director of the Frederick G. Sampson Foundation, where she focuses on theological education and social justice. She is a former Director of Diversity and Inclusion for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. On today's episode, COVID-19 is disproportionately impacting people of color in America. Why is this, and what might the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. have to say to us about the times we're living in? How are we living out or failing to heed his legacy?
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Seems to me that every day the cause for this idea for a podcast becomes more and more intense. We, as we record this, have crossed into a very scary number. 100,000 people in the United States have so far died from this disease. And the highest percentage of those people are in the African-American community, as well as the Native American community and the Latino community. It's a scary prospect. And I think at one point, one of the panelists that's on today pointed out that it might be an apt phrase to say that if Martin Luther King Jr. were here today, that the Dr. King would say, "Can you hear me now?" I think that's the place where we start. What would we need to hear from King now? What did he say during similar, very difficult circumstances? I'll stop there and just let our panelists respond.
Well, I was the one that said, "Can you hear me now?" And when I think of King and all of the things that have happened with COVID-19 and the issues that currently exist today in our nation, I'm sure he would be terribly disturbed. We've had another killing of an African-American male that has also exacerbated the problem. What would King say now? I don't know that he would say, "Can you hear me now?" He would certainly ask for the rioting to cease and for calmer heads to come together. He would certainly not be so passive with those leaders that are causing problems within the community, whether they be the African-Americans inside the community or the other that's on the outside trying to push an agenda that is negative to black and brown folk.
So it's an interesting prospect to think about, can you hear me now, and what would King say in this moment? I think about that question, and I imagine that King in present day would have had the luxury of living through decades of additional growth and experience, to have exponentially learned more about, to have exponentially learned more about humanity, his own leadership, how politics continues to play out. And I am really not sure what King would say. I could certainly go back and read his writings and see which are applicable to this moment. But I think his own individual growth, if you will, would have a significant impact on what it is he would talk about today. In this COVID-19 experience that we are in, to be sequestered in this way, and again, to think about how would he garner direct action and keep people safe. Safe different than safe when black and brown bodies were being beat up for being in the streets for the purpose of protesting, but safe in the sense of fighting this invisible disease and keeping black and brown bodies from being beaten and harmed. The additional weight and responsibility seems to me that would have, would give him reason to even have to think about this and pause even more on how to say what needs to happen and what to say.
I thought about what King would say, and I found myself hard-pressed to think of what he might say, and then I asked myself, what should I be saying and contemplating after all his writings and sermons, and how concerned he was and is for the whole human race. And as I thought about all of this, 100,700 people dead. And yesterday, when that number became apparent, we were looking at the leadership of the nation to see how this moment would impact them and what they would have to say. So as I looked and I thought that would King go back and make a copy of his letter from the Birmingham jail and send it forth and send this scourge that we have in our land. There's one apparent virus, the COVID-19 virus, which requires people to come together and act as one unit in order to defeat a common enemy in the midst. But it's difficult when you have a common enemy in the midst, and then you have another enemy that's a virus that's been around for, it has lasted now for 400 plus years. And that virus happens to be hate and racism and all of those things. So how would Martin actually address those? I think he would probably look and have the same words. I don't know if his words could be any different, but I think his disappointment with where we are today would be grave. And I know that as an African American, there are lots of things that I can do, but there are some things that I can't do to rid this scourge from the land, both the virus and the indifference, the divisiveness that's running so rapidly. So the virus is scary. It can take our lives and all that. But more frightening than the virus is the hate and the divisiveness that I see in the land. It's like provides a petri dish for the virus to run wild. And I hear people talking about it, and there's always this opportunity to, I guess, put oneself in a favorable position. It's almost as if I had nothing to do with that. And until we start to look at it and say that this thing is something in the land that we need to come together. We need to be aware that protesting and rioting will help neither, will highlight the both of them, but they are both still in place unless we have a concerted effort to eradicate the land of both.
I was giving some thought to the I Have a Dream speech, and I think all of us would recognize that the speech is a Jeremiad that sets out the terms of how the American people had or were in violation of God's will and were in violation of the contract that that Americans had made when they said that all people were created equal and said that that was something that was self-evident from what God had wanted. And so here we are looking at a condition that is being exacerbated terribly by the fact that jobs and healthcare are rationed in this country and have been rationed. And King was pointing that out at the time. I mean, that speech was given at a march that was called a March for Jobs and Freedom. And it is clear that income and jobs and education and health care and the isolation of segregation are making this disease so much more of a plague in the African American community. It is not a good thing in anybody's community, but so many people in the white community feel that they can sort of disengage with the sense of seriousness, because in their white communities, the seriousness, unless you are an old person that's in a nursing home, has not been as terrible as it has been for African Americans. At one point, I pointed out to within Stancy Adams's hearing that I had that I knew three African American people who had perished from the disease, and her response was that if you were African American, you would know many more. And that's a sobering thought. I was thinking that knowing three was something significant, and her awareness of so many more is that much more terrible. And so I got to ask the question, what is it that a person who, like me, would call myself a white ally, how should I be responding? The letter from a Birmingham jail is addressed to supposed white allies in Birmingham who are saying, I think, similar things to what white folks say today, which is, you know, we have to address this, but it's going to take time. And, you know, here we are this many years since the 1963 speech, this many years since the 1964 and 5 movement that King was leading, and we are still talking about the same kinds of things. We're still talking about it taking time. And I think that when I reflect on it and I look at myself, I say, this is a problem for the African American community, but without the active participation and fighting back against the public policies that have made this so much more terrible, white folks, their lack of effort is evident, and makes me say that I wonder if we are even going to be able to listen to King. It seems we've got our hands over our ears.
As I listen to each of us give our view on this, and I've been thinking about it for a few weeks now, I don't know that it is even possible to fight two enemies at the same time. You have to choose one or the other. And I would say that in doing that, it would be selecting the issue of biased racism over the COVID issue, because if you fix the one, it will fix the other. So I think that King was on the right track then, but I don't know what he would say now. For you, Bob, I think that it is important that we have white allies. You and I have talked before over some incidents that I would become infuriated with, and you wrote a letter to a system and said everything that I was thinking, because I was too angry and I didn't think that they would hear me, but they would hear you better because they were white. So it is important that we have everyone that is in support of a free society, one that is the one that King spoke of in his I Have a Dream speech, that we have all folk on board, not just a white male, but white females and Arabs and Muslims and whomever else is willing to come aboard. We cannot fight this by ourselves as African Americans. So I think that your input is valuable, and but I think that the energy for the fight has to come from Black and brown people.
So do you despair at the fact that here we are talking about things that we think King would have said in response to what's going on now, and that it's clear that you need very active participation from white allies to break down the segregation, to break down the barriers to opportunities and jobs, to really take on the education system and have it provide equal education to all communities, that here we are talking about this and knowing that we need full and intense participation from the white community, and that isn't there. There's some concern. The concern is larger than than might be thought possible, but the concern is not intense enough. It doesn't have the kind of urgency that is needed, and so I'm wondering if there's some sense of feeling that that despair at not having the kind of public policy allies that are required.
Very interesting point, Bob. I think that it's important that we understand when we start to think of what am I able to do or what are Black people able to do with the system that was not constructed by them for their destruction and oppression, and that which have become such a part of the fabric of a nation, it will take a huge effort on the part of everyone, especially those who are recipients of a system that was designed to do us to treat people and to hold people in a certain place. And I think until those who constructed the system realize that it's not only cause a deficiency in the lives of Black people, but it's a great delimiter and causes the life of everyone in the nation and in the world to be affected in a difficult way. I like it that we are talking about Dr. King and what Dr. King may have said at the particular time and how it would have come forth. But basically, he would have talked about God's purpose for our lives. And when we start to examine the scriptures and that which he believed in so much, I think we look at it from the standpoint of the people that created the system have not addressed the minimizing the difficult effects of the system on the lives of people, and not realizing that it not only affect Black people, but it affect the whole country. And until that happens, until people become aware that I am hurting myself and my family, in addition to all of those, I don't know if there would be very much, that would be an advance toward getting rid of all the things that we're talking about.
It's complex because you both make some salient points, and I'm finding myself in a bit of turmoil when I think about the layers that would have to be addressed to successfully move forward towards any kind of real meaningful enactment around institutional or structural change. And certainly, fundamentally, if we don't bore a hole and decimate a system that has been, that this nation has fundamentally been built on, then I don't know what the Penitent Patrol space is that will actually have a impact. I think about white allyship, and I've been thinking about it, particularly in light of the video that came out just day before yesterday, I believe, regarding the woman who called the police on the gentleman that was bird watching, and how that in Central Park in New York, and how that distressed me. But then what came out after that that distressed me even further was the idea that when a reporter did some investigation into who she is, what came out was that she was a white liberal. And so what broke my heart, or what really compounds the challenging times that we're in, is when those who we are perceiving are our allies, right, that we believe are the ones that are standing toe-to-toe with us as we march forward towards a greater space of justice and equity, when the fragility, even in this moment, the fragility is paramount over the, and I'm speaking generally, is paramount over what occurs on an individual basis, reinforcing a systematic one or a structural one. So when our allies are not really in a trusted space, when many of our allies are not in trusted space, it leads me to say this to you, Bob. What can I ask in terms of white allyship? To do some deep self-work, to be willing to ask yourself and your peers the very challenging question of what would you do in circumstances that you are not, you may not be comfortable in. Who is that real, who would really come to bear in those moments? Because if you find that on one hand you are singing "We Shall Overcome" with and linking arms or bumping elbows with your black and brown brothers and sisters, but the moment you are experiencing some kind of fear or feeling as if you have been told something and that person had no right to say that to you, and you shift gears, then you do no good and you do harm. And so to do that critical self-work, and then to stand up and to speak up to both those who look like you and those who don't look like you, so that we understand and we know for sure who you are in this moment in history, when we are looking back at what our leader in the 60s would say, needing a word, because we need a word right now. We need insight, we need leadership, and as opposed to really thinking about who is amongst us in this present moment, we're finding ourselves having to look back 50 years to garner a voice that gives us the courage and energy to step into what our next must be.
I've been reading a historian that has made some points in what I've been reading lately, Heather Cox Richardson, who points out that from the beginning of our republic, it may surprise many of us that the basis on which the republic was begun was on the basis of oligarchy, and that oligarchy decided that it was a choice between freedom and democracy, and they chose freedom, but not freedom in a sense that we might think of it as being robust and serving everyone, but freedom for themselves. And they saw that democracy, that is, that in the very beginning, of course, if women and men with no property and bonded enslaved people were given the vote, were given some chance of making their voices heard, that what they defined as their freedom would be lost. And so I think we're in a very in a period where we can very clearly see that that's what's happening again, that the forces that are very much awake and that we are aware of in the current political situation are making that same kind of judgment, that if they were to allow general democracy, that is, allow everyone to be heard, they would end up losing what they see as their own wealth and status, and that is why that mythology, that operating principle, is why it's so dangerous, actually, for white folks to really press up against it, and why white folks are so afraid to press up against it, because it's like breaking the atom. It will explode. And it explains to me why, in order to get any kind of really big change, at least even contemplated, it takes violence. It takes people exploding in the streets to say, we won't have this anymore. And many people, especially white folks, are going to look at what's going on now in Minneapolis and say, well, those people are just making it hard on themselves. But as a matter of fact, just watch. Just like every other time there's been that kind of violence, like in Ferguson, Missouri, people are going to take notice, and changes will follow from those. Whether or not those changes will last is another question, because people will continue to plug away at pushing back against them. But it explains to me why it is that you have to have these major disruptions in order to get people to make a change, because until you start to disrupt their economic status, they don't respond. They don't change.
It's interesting. I just read something from Reverend William Lamar IV, who made this statement in a sermon. There comes a time when being nice is the worst kind of violence. Mm. That really resonated with me. And so what we are seeing is violence matching and meeting violence, right? So the young people and the elders who are in the street in this current moment are saying that the violence of being nice and waiting my turn and hoping that things will change one day because we're being nice is much more profound and much more impactful than me stepping out and getting your attention in ways that you may perceive as violent. And I think that's just really compelling, because there is this counter narrative that Martin Luther King was a nice man, and I'm sure he was. But he was also a very strategic, very direct, very complex individual that was not operating under the auspices of being nice. He was operating under the auspices of justice and change. But because his image has been commandeered, the perception is that he was a nice man and these good things came out of that experience. And so, if we can't change his perception of some from some, then we need to step into that idea of, when is nice worse than violence?
Yeah, when does being nice allow the heightened violence to be projected on African Americans through the the accepted public policies of water policy and educational policy and policing policy that are controlled in large part outside of African American communities. I'm reminded, as you say that if anyone reads King's letter from a Birmingham jail, he specifically says that his method of nonviolence is supposed to be disruptive. It's supposed to get people to notice that that you know this is not just pacifism. This is an aggressive form of disruption that is intended to provoke those others to respond and to show their true way of being.
That's interesting for me to hear, and Frieda, thank you for bringing it forth. Nice is the worst kind of violence that you can do, and I've been asking myself, what is violence? Is a short period of disruption really violence to the ongoing, continuous way of violence when you're denied jobs, when you're denied housing, when you're denied health care, when you're denied the basic principles of being a human being? To me, that is the ultimate violence. And when it becomes a part of your life, when it becomes what's expected, when it becomes that when people question it, there's something wrong with it. But when you start to say the mortality rate in this community because of this is here, when there's no water because of this, when there's not educational opportunities, there's no job, to me that's violence. And it becomes one of the violence, it becomes one of those things that the land get used to, is that we can, these violent moments can be perpetrated on this people, but we don't see it as violent because it hasn't made us uncomfortable yet. But the moment you make it uncomfortable, the moment there's a disturbance that lasts, 3 days, the moment a store or something, and I'm not advocating that stores be burned, but the moment that happens, we find a counter narrative to it to determine why all that. But why don't we, if we would only look at the violence that's there, that historically that's been there, that you're still recovering from and that people benefit from. And I think when we look at that violence, yes, being nice is not saying anything about it. I don't know if Dr. King was nice at all, because anytime you bring someone to a place and you put their glaring faults on display, and we have a people that are able to look at it and say that's not so bad. But when I think about it, from the fact when you can put your that which makes you who you are on display and tell the world, this is who this person really is. Now, you can go and lie and you can tell other people that this is the way it is, but evidently we, folk will know the truth about who you are. So today I think he would find some way to bring the conversation that we hear now to light and have people look at it and say, this difficult, although I don't know if it would do any good. I think we've been enculturated in a way now that we become accustomed to. The truth is rare. Untruths are something we learn to live with.
I heard, I'm still pondering over nice being the how did you say it, the worst kind of violence? And I heard a young pastor out of California at Mount Ribidu church, and he said it used to be that I was considered, he was an African American, that he was considered to be dangerous because people thought that he had a weapon. All black folk and brown folk carried guns and knives, and that made them fearful of them because I know that they have a gun or they have some sort of weapon. And now he said, I don't have to carry anything. It is just the color of my skin that makes people fearful of me. They don't think about who I am. They just look at the color of my skin and deem me as dangerous. And so when I combine that with nice, how do you fix that? I'm just kind of perplexed because I'm nice and I'm brown, but I'm a threat. I'm nice and I'm brown and I'm not challenging you, but I'm violent. I just don't get that, but there it is. So what would King do? I don't know. I think at this point he would probably be pretty frustrated 50 years later that some things had not changed. I can't even imagine how he would go about fixing all of these issues. And I guess it just takes me back to not the COVID thing, but let's deal with the biases. And every time we come up with a plan on how we're going to face it, yes, the young people get angry in the streets, and I think that that is so necessary sometimes so that they can be heard. I think that when we sit back and we don't say anything, people get worried, like, well, what's going to happen? And they're waiting for the shoe to fall. I don't know what he would say because I don't know how to perceive the enemy at this point. And going back to what Frida said about the other, those that are other than black or brown, how do you respond in a crisis when it's your life that's on a line, or your character that is in question, or your belief that's in question, under threat?
Well, King might be channeled through, and I'm having a moment here where I think it's Pastor Moss, is that right, from Trinity UCC Church in Chicago? Yes, and I think we may, all four of us, have heard his recent sermon that has gone viral, I think. It's a Jeremiad. He may be exactly the in that moment, the incarnation of King, the reincarnation of King, as he looks at the history from way back then to now, through showing how slavery and enslaving people and enslaving their minds and enslaving their opportunities has not changed. I think that I have personally don't have a lot of trouble seeing King's voice in that, and feeling that it's just the circumstances that have changed, that the Jeremiad is looking at very similar kinds of events. You know, King doesn't mention healthcare and illness among the things that he mentions in the I Have a Dream Jeremiad, but he does talk about the kinds of circumstances that have made this this terrible plague so much worse in the African American community. He could see that, and I'm sure was aware of the history of the syphilis, you know, the syphilis studies that were visited upon African American people in the Tuskegee syphilis study that seemed to make sense somehow to the white doctors that allowed syphilis to run to rage in certain subjects so that they could observe its progress. I'm sure that King was well aware of that, and that's the sort of thing that I think we're seeing today. So that personally, I see King coming and saying exactly that. I said all of these things. You're not listening, and it's still terrible. You're isolating white folks from black folks so that the white folks don't really have to deal with the same kinds of conditions and can somehow plausibly tell themselves that it can't be that bad. We're really trying to solve these problems. We're making some sort of progress. And I think that this COVID-19 has revealed to us that the progress we've made is phantom. It's if people are still living and dying on the basis of the racism in this society, you can hardly call that progress.
Bob, you said something that triggered a thought that is important for me to kind of think about out loud with you, if that's okay with all of you. And I'm thinking about it out loud, because at the top of our conversation, I said, I don't know what Dr. King would say in this moment, because I can only use my imagination of if he were living in this moment, having lived through decades that led up to this moment, who would that man be? And what would the wisdom that he would impart upon us with that collective additional knowledge and experience look like? But I think you said something that really hits home for me, and that is, I think that he would, in the genius that he was, he would delve into a space of creativity to find a way to pull us together in a way with which we have never been pulled together before. And Dr. Moss at Trinity is a profound example of what that looks like real time. I think Dr. King may have said, "Where are you, leaders, in this present moment?" He would certainly be an elder times two, right? So where, I think he would challenge us to say, "What is it that you're doing? Have you not learned anything from what I shared, from my walk, from the walks of those who sacrificed their time, their energy, their resources, and their lives? Have you not learned? Where are you in this space?" And I think Dr. Moss, in his own profound creativity, articulated that with the Requiem, the Cross and the Lynching Tree, a Requiem to Ahmaud Arbery. I think he articulated that. He found a way to communicate with young people and hold the truths of our history with honor and respect, to share it clearly, to connect the dots, and to give us a moment to contemplate, what do we do? I think the church and church leaders, pastors and ministers, theologians, lay people who labor in the vineyard of our religious expressions, I think we have a responsibility. My question to you is, would we be seeing the violence the way we're seeing it play out? We certainly saw it in 67, we're seeing it now. If our religious leaders were stepping into this space of leading, and really taking on the power and articulating the power and the presence of nonviolence and the discipline of, what do you do when you are frustrated, when you are tired, when you are angry, and you've got to do something? What is that disciplined response so that we are able to stay safe, but we're also able to be disruptive?
Yeah, that's something to contemplate, and thanks for directing those thoughts at me, because I really feel like we need, as all four of us are people of faith, we participate at some very active level, I know, all four of us in churches. And I recently was addressing that in something I wrote, that we have these very powerful ethics that are in the case of the four of us, we share Christianity as a basis for our religious beliefs, and so we share a profound and difficult ethic that says, no matter what, we are supposed to be caring for one another. And what has happened is that that churches have allowed their flocks, their people, to become isolated from one another, so that we really then just take care of ourselves to the best that we can. And for some of us, the resources are so tremendous that the best we can is pretty darn good. And for others, the resources are limited and the best they can is fairly limited. And so it's a sad commentary, I think, on the effect of religion. It seems another place where King would have said that it was, you know, it was a paralyzing and it was a sedative for us really, doing what the Jesus ethic would require of us.
That's an interesting place to bring us, Bob, because I've been struggling with that, thinking, because being a preacher, we talk about the good news all the time. And I ask myself, what is the good news for an oppressed people for a number of years. What's that good news? And have I been missing part of it? Is there some aspect of it that I see? And as I was sitting here looking at King's letter from the Birmingham jail, he says something in the middle, and he was talking about Reinhold Niebuhr. He says, "We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed." And I ask myself, how many kinds of ways do you demand that? And I think it has to be one of those things that not only offer an opportunity to say that I'm very, very displeased with this, but then you have to find all the ways that you can that would get the attention of the person that's oppressing you and say to them that it's not a good thing, and this is what it's doing to you, and this is what it's doing to everyone. So when I read that, it's troubling to me. What do I do to let those that oppress know that this is wrong? And I understand, regardless of what your rhetoric might say, you are not going to voluntarily give up the position that you find yourself in because of your belief in God or your studies of what Christ had to say. None of that's going to make a difference. Because you see it the way you've been enculturated to see it, the way you feel, and the way you feel comfortable seeing it. And to may even be unaware that you're a recipient, that people can be unaware that they are recipients of oppression. And as long as I'm receiving that, that put me in a privileged position, I have no... There are very few scriptures in the Bible that's going to make me change my mind, because I will do all the things that I can, you know, in addition to exegeting them, I will eisegete them, and we've seen plenty of that. So I ask myself, when we come to talk to people about the good news that's in the Bible, what does Jesus mean when he comes and say the Spirit of the Lord is upon me? Does it make me timid, or does it make me do that which causes those that are oppressing that oppress us to feel uncomfortable, and life become uncomfortable for them in the place that they are in? I'm not talking about burning things. I'm talking about the way we treat and talk to people about situations of life. That is not something I agree with. That is not something I even embrace. I don't see it that way. And because when I start to think about it, I struggle with the fact that all my life I have to ask myself, why do I believe what I believe? Who taught me what I know? And then once I go back and start to examine it, I find some very difficult situations there that make me uncomfortable as hell. So thank you. So I think that's what Dr. King would say to us, you know. And I think Reverend Adams said, "Can you hear me now?" I think his "Can you hear me now?" is, have you examined yourself to see what you can do about all of this?
And listening to what you have to say, and asking for freedom, and we must ask for it because people are not going to freely give it to you. And I think back to King. He had some tools that he was able to work with that affected was going to truly have an impact today. He had the threat of the march and requesting civil rights, so much so, putting so much pressure on President Johnson until he had to do what he did. The reason that Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation is because of the pressure. Whatever is going to happen with African Americans, it must have a financial impact on the other. That is when people start to listen. You can tell me that you want freedoms, and I can go along with it to a point, as long as it does not affect who I am and make me uncomfortable in my pocketbook. And that seems to be the only way that that white folk listen. You know, when you start to impact the stock market, when you start to infringe upon financial institutions that is going to impact them, then they will sit up and take note as they try to devise ways to keep you from doing so. But all of the things, everything that has happened, I don't care how far back in history we go, and we're talking about religion, Jesus went into the temple and turned over tables because they were selling in his house of prayer. You know, money is one of the conversations that you must have in order to get what it is you want. You know, and I truly agree with King feeling so, with the Jeremiah feeling so cheated. You know, you promised one thing and you did something else. And they did something else because to do the thing that they promised, giving equality and freedom, would mean that they would have to change some of their ways of doing business. It would mean that now I perceive that my property value will go down if Black folk move into my neighborhood. I perceive that if we allow African Americans, women, others, to move up into an economic level where they're able to do the same things that I do, that threatens the structure. And I don't really want that to happen. Only when you start to impact the finances that got King killed, got Jesus killed. Where are we today?
Do you think that it is possible that we could have a Montgomery bus boycott moment in 2020? Is there the discipline, is there the capacity to make the sacrifice to withhold our buying power, our spending power, to create the impact, to create that disruption, to rally the attention and garner the capacity to shift some of those structural and institutional nuances that's so fundamentally built into our institutions? Is it even possible for us to go back or to step forward and make the kind of sacrifice that might say you can't spend your money on stuff for the next year, and let the pain point be, to your point, Reverend Adams, in your wallet? Is it possible? Can we do that?
I think that it would be difficult because many of our young people have not been taught to be as passive as the people back during the boycott. They've not endured some things. But I think that if we could garner enough of our Black and white leaders together, it would make an impact. But I think that we have enough people that have money that can make a stance. And if they're willing to do it, can you imagine if Oprah Winfrey just decided that I'm not going to invest my money into anything that is going to impact negatively the African-American community for a solid year? It might be painful and hurt her financially, but she's willing to make the sacrifice. I think that it's possible. Maybe I'm an optimist, but I think that that's what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to do something that impacts the pockets of the affluent. Our wonderful president is ready for people to go back to work and for the country to be back up and rolling, because it's affecting the financial structure of the country. And he's losing money personally if people aren't able to go to his golf courses. If we do what we need to do, I believe that those Montgomery boycotts and all of those things can impact our society today. It will not be the Montgomery boycott. It might be something else that we can do. But yes, I think it would make a difference because we must impact them financially. And I think that's what King figured out, that it has to be a financial impact in order to get the attention for people to give us equality. But aren't we working in little silos where we could ask them to come together? We have a LeBron James that has a school that is just doing wonderful, wonderful things. And we have some other people that have a lot of money in the Black community. They might not think they're in our community, but they're Black. And if we could just get them to come together, we could make the same impacts. We just have to look at them not as a Fannie Lou Hamer, because she didn't have the money, but she had power. They have money and power. and they have power that's recognized by the other. I think that it is possible. I think that no one has gone to them and expected anything of them other than what they can invent on their own. We're not asking you to do it forever, but I want you to do it in order to make a difference. And I think that there is a consciousness that we can raise in them that will make a difference. We just underestimate them.
I love what you're saying, but then the question comes to me. All of those are wonderful names you've called up, but the thing that haunts me is that what voice do I have? And how am I able to influence people that are around me? And collectively, when we start to think about doing that, if we come with the conscious, we come with the idea that there's going to be one Martin King, there was one Jesus, there was one Kobe Bryant, and all of those, they just happen to be doing something that we say, and we realize that it's extraordinary. I think we come and look and ask ourselves, what can I do? And then immediately say, well, I'm not able to do anything. Well, you may not be able to change the lives of but two or three, four or five people, and knowing that one of those people might be the next person that will change the world completely. I ask myself, what would Dr. King say to me today? You got every book that ever wrote on your library shelf. You read most of them. Now, do you hear what I had to say? And that was not meant for just your education. It was meant to mold your thinking. It was made to make you think about things differently and to ask yourself, what can I do in the arena that I find myself in the arena of life, whether it be a minister, whether it be going to work every day. But my conversation has to be about the contention of life in which we find ourselves in. And I think that's the way we bring to bear all those. I think that's one way that we can do those things. And it will prevent us from sitting. We're asking the question, what would Dr. King say if he was here? I think that Dr. King would, and I hate to think it, it bothers me. If I met him, he would probably, first thing he would say to me is, what are you doing? What are you doing? You read all the books. It's almost like reading the Bible. If Jesus shows up, he's going to ask me, you know, what did you do? What are you doing? You know, you read this and you read it and you read it. Are you looking for another prophet? Are you looking for me to come again? Or are you taking that message to heart and going to do something with it?
And taking it to heart, and you take the message. I'm sure that when Otis Moss made his fabulous speech that has gone viral, he didn't intend or didn't anticipate it going viral at the time. You have a voice. We all have a voice. And we just have to start using it collectively. You might only be able to impact a certain number of people, but at least you can impact it. And now with social media, it is possible for that to go all over the world. So I think that he would ask, what are you doing? You can't say I don't have a voice or who's going to listen. I did that for a long time. Who's going to listen? And it's amazing at the number of people that will listen to you if you speak up. But if you never speak up and come up with reasons why you shouldn't, because I'm not a Fannie Lou Hamer, I'm not a Ida B. Wells, I'm not a King, I'm not any of those things, I'm just Stancy, then I'm not going to say anything. But if I believe that in me, there is something that needs to be said that is going to be inspirational to others if they will just listen. If I never say it, they're not going to hear it. But if I say it, it might spark a fire somewhere.
As you were saying that, and I know we look at and we think about what would King speak and what would King say about today. And simply because I believe that collectively, people are not speaking up today, are not saying anything today. So we see some of the gross inequities that we see continuously perpetuated on those that are here, even the highest officers in the land. You know, people say, okay, you can say anything you want, and we're not going to say anything because we don't want to deal with the repercussions. I think that comes all the way down to where we are in people at all levels of life.
I'm just going to say that we've lost track of time, actually, because of the depth of this discussion. And that's a good thing. And I think ending on the fact that we don't have the clear answer and that we are asking what are the questions that need to be asked, and are we the ones that are willing to both ask those questions and provide some of the answers? Seems to me to be as good a place as any to stop and leave it for those who listen to this to offer to us their response to those questions. So if it's okay with the other panelists, I'll just draw this discussion to a close right now and hope that others will help us continue it.
Thank you for listening to the Faith and Works podcast, sponsored by the Interfaith Leadership Council of Metropolitan Detroit. Today's music comes from bensound.com, royalty-free music. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.